491.3 FM WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark in the great state of Delaware, I'm Bill Humphrey, and thanks for listening. The following episode was recorded and produced for WVUD and our podcast listeners by me at my studio in Newton, Massachusetts. The opinions represented in this program by hosts or guests do not necessarily reflect those of WVUD, the University of Delaware, or my own political campaign committee. Episodes are available for download on Tuesdays at arsenalfordemocracy.com and from iTunes or Stitcher. We air the show in Delaware on 91.3 FM and stream it simultaneously from WVUD.org on Tuesdays at 12:30 p.m. Eastern. Follow us on Twitter at AFDRadio or like us on Facebook. This is the Arsenal for Democracy.
This land is your land. This land is my land. California. New York Island. Redwood Forest, Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you and me.
You're listening to Arsenal for Democracy, episode 329, recorded on October 18th, 2020. I'm your host, Bill Humphrey. And joining me on the line this week from New York instead of Washington is Kelly. Hi, Kelly. Welcome back.
Hi, Bill. Thanks for having me.
So Rachel is out this week because it's her birthday. Happy birthday to Rachel. Kelly is filling in for Rachel today. And since you have moved to New York City, we are going to talk about something related to New York history to welcome you to the new home that you'll be at for the foreseeable future. And as we are both Massachusetts people, I have to say, I think you and I are in the same position on this, which is that we don't know a lot about New York history. It's not something that's really emphasized in Massachusetts public schools with their very strong emphasis on the importance of Massachusetts in U.S. history and the pervasive view that New York City is the enemy. Would you agree with that characterization?
Yeah, absolutely. I distinctly remember a lesson on geography in third grade in which the teacher was adamant that New York is not a part of New England, and our history lessons certainly focused on New England.
Now, part of the reason that, you know, the Massachusetts history is completely different is that the American Revolution, of course, kicked off in Massachusetts, and then New York City was occupied by a little bit over a year later by the end of August of 1776 and remained occupied by the British literally until the end of the war. And there was definitely a lot of support for in New York City for remaining with the crown, which was a lot less extensive in, say, New England. So that is sort of one reason why there's a difference in kind of how it's the historiography of it. But since Nate and I a couple weeks ago had talked about the connections between the Boston Revolt in 1689 and the Leisler's Rebellion in New York City, I thought it would be good to keep looking for some other New York City history to familiarize ourselves with that and welcome Kelly to her new city. And what I came upon was the New York Conspiracy of 1741 as something that I wanted to talk about. And we'll get into a second what that was and kind of the background around that. But it is interesting that what we talked about, what Nate and I talked about a couple weeks ago, was this sort of twin uprising in Boston and New York City in 1689. And part of that, a big part of that, was resentment about New York City and Boston being grouped together in this new attempted consolidated New England colony that the British monarchy was attempting to establish. And this did not go over very well. And the Glorious Revolution happened and sort of undid a lot of that consolidation process. And New York City and Boston went their separate ways. And then what we didn't talk about on that episode is that shortly after the events in Boston, and Nate alluded to some of the key figures in this, the Salem witch trials hysteria kicked off in the greater Boston region, and that was what was happening in Boston at the time. And then several decades later, about 50 years later, we arrive at the New York Conspiracy of 1741, which is a bit of a similar type of phenomenon, but with some slightly different dimensions, although there were certainly some religious dimensions there as well. And that's what Kelly and I are going to talk about today. So the events in 1741, which Kelly's about to explain what happened. I'll just say, was a wave of mass arrests, executions, and deportations over an imagined conspiracy of poor whites and black slaves to seize power in New York City, which was at the time a major slave city in the British North American colonies. It is often compared to the hysteria of the Salem witch trials in the 1690s, about a half century earlier, because of coercion of unreliable witness accusations. And as some additional background context, this hysteria, because as we're about to talk about the conspiracy, it's referred to as the New York Conspiracy of 1741, but there's not a whole lot of evidence that there really was an actual conspiracy. So it's more about the sort of crackdown on this. This hysteria arguably took place during the War of the Austrian Succession, but the view from the colonies was quite different. And this is something that Nate and I also talked about on our episode about the Boston Revolt and Leisler's Rebellion, is this way that there was the interplay with the wars that were happening on the European continent versus the colonial wars that were happening in North America. So there were some relationship between those, but it was not always super closely integrated. So there was a pre-existing war in North America known as the War of Jenkins' Ear, due to an incident 10 years earlier in 1731, before the conflict started, when a Spanish Navy interaction with an alleged British smuggler resulted in a man named Jenkins getting his ear cut off. While the conflict over Austria in continental Europe did not kick off until the end of 1740, the longstanding trade tensions and colonial Georgia-Florida border disputes between the Spanish and British had erupted into armed actions by 1739, and New Yorkers were convinced by 1741 that a Spanish attack on New York and a slave insurrection backed by Spain was imminent, hence the hysterical reaction that we're about to talk about. The War of Jenkins' Ear is the term used to refer specifically to the British-Spanish conflict in the Americas as opposed to the wider war and as opposed to the British-French indigenous conflict in the Americas that also happened slightly later but also tied into the War of Austrian Succession later in the 1740s, which was known as King George's War. A lot of these are named for whoever was the person on the throne in England at the time. So you got King George's War, Queen Anne's War, that sort of thing. So, Kelly, let's talk about the so-called conspiracy in New York City in 1741 and the reaction to it. What is it that they thought that was happening, and then what sort of unfolded from there?
Sure. So amongst that backdrop of fear, which is very important to remember to understand what happened next, there were a series of 13 fires in Lower Manhattan in March and April of 1741. And the biggest fire was at Fort George, which was the home of the governor. So these weren't sort of small things, but they appeared to be arson and quite targeted at the well-to-do in the colony at the time. So there were these 13 fires. People really can't figure out what's going on. And then all of a sudden, they've arrested an Irish indentured servant whose name was Mary Burton over an unrelated case. She had stolen something. And in her, as she's about to be tried for this crime of stealing something, she starts to say that there is this conspiracy going on, and that these 13 fires are part of a much larger plot in which the owners of the tavern that she works at and slaves across the city are trying to take down the leaders and set themselves free. And it's also important to remember at this time that the city, about 20% of the city's 10 to 11,000 residents were slaves. So those who were owners of slave, on top of sort of the anti-Catholic, anti-Spanish sentiment happening, were also aware that their city was, there were quite a number of slaves in their city. And they really wanted to keep any sort of unrest at bay. So they overreacted, of course. Based on this testimony of Mary Burton, she turned in the owner of the tavern where she worked. And that owner was John Hewson. And he was well known in criminal rings. I'm not really sure how else to say it, but his tavern sort of seemed to be a hub of a lot of criminal activity, or what at the time was deemed criminal, like talking out against your master or that sort of thing. So she turned in the John Hewson, his wife, and then two slaves and a prostitute who frequented the tavern. And remember, again, she worked at this tavern, so she's turning in these people and saying that she overheard this while she was working at the tavern. So this sort of sets off a string of convictions, really without any more evidence than Mary Burton's testimony. And there's some theories. Historians have spent a lot of time thinking about how true what Mary Burton said is. And some of those theories are that John Hewson was doing some sort of criminal planning to take over a crime ring, and he had been telling slaves that they were free, that he would free them. And so in that sense, there may have been something happening, but it probably wasn't quite like the conspiracy theory that Mary Burton laid out in her testimony. So once she sort of does that initial turn in of the tavern owner, his wife, these slaves, and a prostitute, people sort of start to turn on each other, turn each other in. Again, this is why there's a lot of comparison to the Salem witch trials. And so eventually, how this all ends up stopping is that people begin to name some of the wealthy, influential New Yorkers at the time, and then they decided to sort of call it quits. This had gone too far. So she was,
Basically, again, the same thing happened in Salem too, right? Once you get to a point where you're naming people who are too important, then you shut it down.
Yeah, exactly what happened here. And so she was given her, I think, £100 and her freedom, and she sort of went on her way. And sort of in her wake was the wrongful, what very much appears to be the wrongful conviction of many of the slaves in New York who were burned across the city, sort of for others to see, to the point about really wanting to send a message and quell any sort of potential rebellion. And most of what we know about the trial today is based on Daniel Horsmonden's writing, The New York Conspiracy, in which he documented the trials firsthand at the time. He too was trying to write it in an attempt to sort of document the evil of Black people and, you know, the way that they were trying to ruin the city. But of course, now as we review it, we see that it is, you know, a text that really reminds us both of the horrors of slavery and of wrongful conviction. So certainly not a text that age very well.
So let's talk about some of the analyses since then, sort of more modern look backs on this period, what happened. To my mind, you know, it's not just the obvious comparison to the Salem witch trials, but this also does feel like, even though it's maybe a lesser known historical event, it feels sort of, if not foundational, let's say a harbinger of things to come in American history, the way that they sort of immediately went into overdrive to try to prevent any cross-racial organizing and solidarity, even whether it was real or imagined, between Black and white folks, you know, who were either slaves or indentured servants or other sort of very low on the totem pole people. You have this sort of just racial paranoia, this nationalist or proto-nationalist paranoia, because of course it's not the nation at this point, but let's say a sort of a vague British or New York patriotism against this perceived Spanish threat that they were convinced that this was a threat. And that, of course, becomes like a major theme, I think, in a lot of American history, of like constantly fearing that some outside power is going to intervene and manipulate the slaves into rising up and overthrowing the United States system. What are some of the takeaways from sort of modern analyses by scholars of the events of 1741?
I mean, one of the things that struck me while reading a number of, you know, web pages on this is that there's sort of this big wind up about the relationship with Spain at the time and all the anti-Catholic sentiment. And then it's sort of the story gets to the point where Mary Burton, this indentured servant from Ireland, speaks out. She was sort of exactly the kind of person that they were afraid would be, you know, planning with slaves some sort of rebellion. And then all of a sudden, like, the story totally changes and they seem to trust her over any of the slaves who are obviously speaking out for themselves, or, you know, anyone else. So I was really interested by this sort of this racial dynamic on top of like the underlying anti-Catholic sentiment and everything else happening at the time, how eventually this racism resulted in slaves and the owner of the tavern who, you know, associated with slaves burning, while sort of Mary Burton at the time was thought to be the hero of this whole thing by uncovering this fake conspiracy theory. And so I dug into that a little bit and found that it was not just, you know, it was not just racism, but it was the institutionalized racism in the way the legal system worked at the time. So I'm going to read a quick excerpt. The trials revealed a minor, but in the circumstances fateful, consequence of the inability of whites and blacks to communicate with one another, except in the narrowest terms of master and slave. When black prisoners called white character witnesses, usually their masters, the whites were unable to speak on the slaves' behalf. For example, Adolf Philip C., called by Cuffy, could only say he had left his slave at home. As to his character, he knew nothing. John Roosevelt and his son thought Quack could not be involved in any mischief, but the best they could say of him was Quack was employed last year to work at the New Battery and that he minded his business very well. So there is institutionalized structures to keep blacks and whites from speaking out for one another, on behalf of one another in the courts. And of course, this, given that the legal system was run by white people, this left the black prisoners and slaves really enslaved people really without a lifeline in this trial and in this legal system. And so I think one of the things that it is a harbinger for is that there were enslaved black people at the time in New York City. There were indentured servant white people who on paper seemed to have, you know, a lot in common as far as some of the trials and tribulations that they were facing at the time. And one would think logically that they would be able to sort of team up and maybe, you know, fight for their freedoms together. But of course, time and time again in American history, that has simply not happened, both because of racism, plain and simple, and then also because of the ways in which our legal system in our government has institutionalized racism to really prevent, in many cases, white and black folks from working together to sort of better their circumstance.
Right. It seems like a key theme here, and again, another one that is a prefiguration of the rest of American history, is that when we're talking about what happened with these trials, it's not just a matter of, you know, oh, the white slave owners or other white people being, you know, when they tried to call them for witnesses, they just would, you know, were unwilling to back them up, or that there was different, you know, that there was somehow different treatment on an individual basis. It's not that. It's as you said, it's institutionalized. There was state power enforcing these distinctions. And I think there is a distinction to be made between white supremacy that's emerging out of personal racial animus and white supremacy that's emerging out of a specific state policy intended to achieve particular economic objectives, right? The objective of classifying these, you know, stratifying all these different categories and creating these provisions in the court of law where, you know, legally you couldn't call a white person to be your character witness as a black slave or a former slave or whatever. There's a reason for doing that, and it's to try to prevent this type of cross-racial cooperation. So it's not just a matter of, you know, oh, there weren't any white people that had the backs of these black people. I mean, again, part of the conspiracy allegation was literally that you had this tavern owner that was allegedly conspiring to liberate the slaves. And so you can see that there was a state policy at work here designed to create stratifications that would prevent cooperation amongst different people, people who might otherwise have a common interest, which is not to say there's no role of racial animus in any of this on an interpersonal level, but that it is important to, I think, to look at these kind of incidents in American history and say, okay, how much of this is some sort of irreconcilable racial difference that is just these people can't get along, which is what you hear sometimes people arguing, oh, you know, they're never going to be able to get along. And you hear that from both the right and from some liberals, and given specific perspectives anyway, versus this idea of, well, there were attempts to cooperate across these lines, and these were thwarted by specific state policies that had very material economic objectives. Another theme that I wanted to talk about is to drill down a little bit on that issue of the Spanish and the anti-Catholic dimension of this. It seems like, you know, because right now in our current context, there's a lot of discussions about conspiracy theorizing around things like QAnon or, you know, what level of involvement Russia is playing in various U.S. affairs. And I think sometimes that's blown out of proportion. And it's, again, if you want to talk about harbingers, you look at stuff like this, you know, because we often hear people bring up things like the Salem witch trials to talk about how that, you know, was foreshadowing a lot of like religious extremism in the United States and reactionary religious politics. But in this particular instance, we're seeing another emerging force. And I don't think it's just as simple as, you know, oh, it was anti-Spanish because there was a conflict with Spain, or it was anti-Catholic because that was a particular context and time. I think there is some element here as well, again, about the role that some of this conspiracy theorizing plays. And who knows, you know, we don't necessarily have the records. Maybe there was some Spanish plot or thought toward establishing a plot in New York City to weaken the British colonies. But in all likelihood, there probably wasn't. And then you start wanting to ask those questions about, well, where was this coming from? What are the motives of fomenting a conspiracy theory like this rather than an actual conspiracy?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there seemed to be sort of fear on a number of fronts, which I think is how conspiracy theories are often born. And this seemed in many ways to sort of like confirm people's fears about what was happening in the city and on the other side of the world. And it's just, it's easier for the people in positions of power and privilege to sort of prove their own conspiracy theory than for those who have, you know, reason to revolt to actually conspire.
Yeah, I mean, for all we know, yeah, there was this climate of fear involving Spain, and the same thing as with the Boston Revolt and the Leisler's Rebellion. You get these accusations, which then becomes a major theme well into the 19th century of, you know, Popish Catholic plots, essentially. That's a huge feature of American politics in the early part of American history and the colonial period. But it seems convenient for them to use that as a pretext if they have concerns that, you know, this large population of black slaves is getting too cozy potentially, or might get too cozy with the white indentured servant population. This is a very good pretext to break that up. And I don't know, you know, if Mary Burton, the Irish indentured servant, was Irish Catholic or not, because there are certainly many Irish Protestant figures in early colonial American history as well. But I would guess that there were a lot of Catholic indentured servants if they were coming from places like Ireland. And so that may have also, again, been more of a pretext thing that, you know, the conspiracy theory element becomes this pretext for achieving these other objectives potentially.
I think the other thing that I would add, just because I don't think I named it yet, was just really the horror of what happened to the people who were tried and convicted across the city. 17 blacks and 4 whites were convicted and hanged. 13 blacks were burned at the stake. 70 black individuals were banished from New York State. 7 white individuals were also deported. And so this really, as far as the desire to send a message to enslaved Black people and working class white people across the city, they certainly sent a pretty strong and horrific message.
Right, and I think that gets exactly to that state policy issue again. You can, you know, complain about, you know, or you can wonder why, you know, the poor whites and the poor or enslaved Blacks were not cooperating more closely in American history. But in the 1740s, you have New York City burning people at the stake and otherwise horribly executing them or deporting people for, you know, even allegedly cooperating across racial lines. And as you said, that's intended to send a very strong message to prevent any such future actions. And I think that was a pretty strong deterrent, you know, much more so than you know, the question of are there irreconcilable differences across racial lines. All right. Well, as always, if you go to arsenalfordemocracy.com with the episode link, each week we put up a PDF that has the links of the various articles that we read as source material, and Kelly's done a lot of work on gathering some really interesting articles on that, so check that out. Kelly, thank you so much for coming on to talk this week about the New York conspiracy of 1741 and, you know, as a way of getting introduced to your new home city.
Yeah, thanks for having me and helping me dig into the history here.